Good morning, everybody. This is Peter Angood. I'm the Senior Advisor for Patient Safety at the National Quality Forum. I oversee all of the patient safety programs for NQF, and I'd like to thank each of you for joining us today. The NQF is moving into a new era where we're doing a lot of our work by conference call, and we appreciate your joining us for that type of a strategy. We recognize that face-to-face meetings are sometimes a little bit more optimal, but they're also difficult to coordinate and get everyone's schedule finalized for them. So far, we've been having good success with these conference call approaches, but it does take a lot of time, and we certainly will have some breaks put into place, et cetera. For those of you who are just signed on, the website is up. The agenda is there. Basically, what we're going to do over the next couple of minutes is we'll do a roll call. When your name is called, we'd ask for you to just briefly introduce yourself, just a brief acknowledgement of what organization you're with and what your interest in this particular project is. And at the same time, we'll be asking for you to disclose any potential conflicts of interest. We'll go around the virtual table to make sure everyone understands who everybody is. Ann Hammersmith, in a moment, will give you some formal information regarding the disclosure. After we do that, I'll just provide a couple of moments of perspective for this project and where we've come so far. Then I'll be turning it all over to Stancil to run the conference, and Lindsay, Melinda Murphy, and myself will be on the line the entire time and be available for offering context and perspective as we move forward. So with that as an initial early introduction, Lindsay, if you could do the role. I'm sorry, Ann first. Ann, can you give your little bit of information about disclosure of interest, and then we'll get Lindsay to do the roll call.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. This is Ann Hammersmith. I'm NQF's General Counsel. At this time, we'd like to do an oral disclosure of interest. If you recall, before you came onto the committee, we asked that each of you complete a written disclosure of interest, which you all did. Thank you very much. And the reason for the oral disclosure is in the spirit of NQF's openness and transparency, and so that each of you will have some sense of where your fellow committee members are coming from. I do want to remind you that you are on the committee as an individual, that you are not representing the interests of the organization with which you're associated, or if you were nominated by an organization, you are not representing their interests either. When we go around the virtual table, as Peter said, we don't expect you to summarize your CV. If you could simply tell us who you're with and if there's anything that you wish to disclose. So I'm going to call the roll of Stancil Riley.
Yes, this is Stancil Riley. I'm the executive director of the Massachusetts Board of Medicine. Before coming here to do that, I was a cardiothoracic surgeon in Huntsville, Alabama for 23 years. I have nothing to disclose.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Riley. James Baggian, are you on the phone? Okay, I guess he's not on the phone. Lee Hamby.
Lee Hamby, Chief Medical Officer for Piedmont Healthcare in Atlanta. Prior to that, practicing general surgeon. Don't know if it's worthy to disclosing, but I'm also associate professor of the School of Public Health at Emory University.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Hamby. William Rosenblatt.
Hi, Bill Rosenblatt. I'm a practicing plastic surgeon in New York. Don't believe I have anything to disclose. I do have my own ambulatory OR.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Rosenblatt. Gina Thronberry.
Good morning. My name is Gina Thronberry. I'm the Assistant Vice President of Corporate Services for Symbion Healthcare based here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a nurse, and I'm a member of the Freestanding Ambulatory Surgery Association of Tennessee, and I'm also a AAA HC surveyor.
Okay, thank you very much. Richard Ehrman. I guess he's not on the phone. And Deborah Wheeler.
This is Debbie Wheeler. I am the Director of Quality Improvement at United Healthcare Nevada, which includes not only the health plan, but an ambulatory surgery center, physician office and sister home health company, and I have no conflicts to disclose.
Okay, thank you. Do any of you have any questions of each other or of me or anything you want to discuss about the disclosures?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ann. And thank you, everybody. In listening to the roster here, we do have good diversity, and we obviously have expertise in this particular area of environment. I think pretty much all of you attended the orientation call, but I do just want to remind you that this Serious Reportable Events program is being supported through some work with the Department of Health and Human Services. NQF has had the Serious Reportable Events program now almost a decade. This is its third update, and in the processes of deciding how to approach this third update, there was the decision made as well to expand into some new environments of care. The steering committee has met several times. They've revised the definition of a serious reportable event, and the decision to move into these three environments of ambulatory or office-based surgery, physician practice environment, and long-term care of the skilled nursing facilities is the initial expansion into other environments. This program is highly taken up in the external environment. There are 28 state-based reporting agencies out there. Most all of them use some version, if not a direct transfer of the NQF Serious Reportable Events list as their reporting tool. The federal reporting strategy with patient safety organizations in their common formats has the Serious Reportable Events in place. A variety of payers and a variety of healthcare systems utilize this as part of their quality improvement strategies as well as their payment strategies. Obviously, CMS has taken up some of these serious reportable events for their non-payment strategy as well. NQF does not participate in how these serious reportable events are taken up. Our focus is on the events themselves and their appropriateness as well as the other criteria for being on this list. The review of the existing serious reportable events is important so that we refine this list, and we've had several comments made about how to refine them. The addition of new serious reportable events is a good opportunity not only to add to the main list, but also to provide new SREs into these specific environments. As we go through the deliberations today, there may be opportunity that a new serious reportable event comes up in discussion that's not already submitted. We are open to that. However, if the group wants to propose a new topic that's not already on the list, then we will require that that be submitted through the formal submission form in order for completeness. We are trying to run each of these taps in a fairly uniform fashion, as well as trying to run the steering committee along the lines of our well-established consensus development process. By participating in this TAP, it certainly does give you opportunity to bring in new ideas at a late stage, but in order to have the continuity of process, we do want to make sure that we put the information into these forms and process them through this TAP as well as the steering committee. I wouldn't view that as an impediment. It's just a necessary step. So if there's a good opportunity, please go ahead and bring your ideas up. And one last comment for perspective. The consensus development process and the endorsement by NQF of a variety of measures and standards is an important one. NQF typically does not develop any measures or standards. When we submit a call for measures, the measures are submitted by external measures developers, and then those measures go through this review process. The SREs are unique in that, yes, NQF is their program, and it has been their program from the beginning. But it's important that we do still follow this consensus development process in that whole sequence. So there is opportunity for public comment. There is opportunity for our approvals board to review these critically. And then once approved, there is opportunity for an appeals process and all of this. It's meant to be open. It's meant to be transparent. And through this call, intermittently, we will ask for public comment if there's anyone attending on our public line. I think I've covered most all of the points that I wanted to raise. I'm happy to answer any further questions or provide further clarification if there are any.
Peter, this is Lee Hamby from Piedmont Healthcare. I had a question about the context of our deliberations as it relates to the title of our TAP about office or ambulatory-based surgery. At some point I saw surgery centers, and I'm wondering if we should really be focused only on the surgical aspect, or do we think about sort of ambulatory centers that have other things such as radiation therapy, you know, oncology, medical practice, that kind of center that, you know, there seems to be more and more of those going on. Are we only focused on the surgical aspect?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. We really pretty much just want to stay focused on the surgical components. We recognize there's a whole host of other types of ambulatory or outpatient types of activities beginning, and we do have the TAP focused on physician practices, and we touched on a couple of those components that you just mentioned in that deliberation, but this TAP we want to just pretty much stay focused on the surgical environment.
Thank you.
I did remind myself that I needed to put another component of context for you. The TAP is focusing on these topics and provides opinion and input, but the steering committee is the one that makes the final decisions and the final choices on whether or not any of the changes or recommendations are kept on the final versions that are submitted for approval by our consensus standards approval committee and the board. Sometimes the TAPs get way deep or tend to get way deep into the nuances of a particular issue, and we'll monitor that. It's certainly important to have good open discussion, but decision points on appropriateness of a particular topic and how it's resolved will lay with the steering committee in the end. But your recommendations are highly important, and we don't want to impede any of that discussion.
This is Bill Rosenblatt. In relationship to the last comments that were made regarding outpatient work, whether it be surgery or stuff, in New York State, when we put out our reporting requirements, it was very interesting because originally our definition basically started with a definition of anesthesia, and it was reporting events relating to procedures that had anesthesia to a certain degree of sedation. And then we found with all of the reporting that came through that so much of the reporting was not related to true surgery, but procedures that were done in ambulatory settings where sedation was used, but things such as radiologic places where they sedated the patient and they moved clots from shunts, GI cases. So that's what sort of happened in New York State. Actually, complications from surgical procedures from plastic surgeons, dermatologists, and others was extremely minor compared to the other reports that we got.
Good point, and that's specifically why we wanted you on the TAP. Give us some of the New York perspective. We can stop right now and deliberate this a little bit further in terms of definition if you'd like. We can open up the aperture. We don't want to make this overly restrictive, and yet we don't want to make it too expansive. We want to hit a good balance, and then what you just described about the New York experience, I think is good. Stancil, how would you like to go ahead with that?
Thank you very much. I would like to take a chance to thank everybody for participating in this. In sort of a follow-up to what Bill was saying, in Massachusetts, we've only recently decided to license ambulatory surgery centers. So until now, we actually haven't had any reporting of events from those centers. So we're just beginning to do that, you know, knowing that that's where almost everything is moving to is outpatient. So we have great things for hospitals to report about, and we aren't sure about exactly the kinds of things that ambulatory surgery centers should report on. I have the feeling that that they're different than what the hospital reports are. Just like Bill said, our definition of office-based surgery was essentially an anesthesia definition in terms of depth of anesthesia. And so I'm very interested in the kinds of things that that have been found there. Certainly, ambulatory surgery centers have some of the same kinds of things that that hospitals have. I mean, we have burns that can occur with preps. We have probably patient falls, and then, of course, all the wrong sites. And then I guess in the end, the complication that Bill was talking about, and that would be transfer to a hospital, would be something that would be of interest to know about too. So I think the beginning place for us is to start with the 28 things that we have and go through and see which ones of them we think are appropriate to the setting of ambulatory surgery and see if we need to talk about implementation guidelines in a different way than necessarily they're listed in your handout that you have there. So I think that going through the events, looking at some of the specifications and seeing how implementing these in different settings of care, the office and the ambulatory surgery center is what we're going to spend a portion of time, at least this beginning time on. So obviously we can start with a surgical event since that's what we're really interested in, and that would be surgery performed on the wrong body part. I think everybody has probably done wrong body part to the max, at least in hospitals. But the question is, in the ambulatory surgery center, there are probably really good guidelines about timeouts and exactly patient identification and all the other important issues, but I'm not sure that that translates into the office setting. So if anybody has something they'd like to bring up about that, I think that's a good place that we can start.
Yeah, it's Peter Angood. If you read in the implementation guidance column, column B, there is some definitions around invasive procedures in the middle of that those paragraphs there that helps with that previous discussion as well.
So you know, since this includes endoscopies that happen, I'm not sure exactly the kinds of endoscopies that might happen to a wrong body part, but it's certainly a huge piece of what happens in ambulatory centers. Bill, any comments or Lee or Debbie? Gina?
And this is Debbie Wheeler. I know in Nevada, obviously, that is an issue in the past few years, that specific issue. So our ambulatory surgery centers actually do report this information to the state in addition to other centers. So I would think that, you know, in the office setting, it, you know, even if they're doing this type of surgery, it would be appropriate, obviously, to put that in.
This is Gina. I agree with her. I know corporately, we have our facilities to report all wrong sites to us, and we have facilities in 28 states, and a majority of those states also have the facility to report to that state.
Well, in the context of the modification suggestions made on the spreadsheet, I think they're pointing out what we're sort of talking about is that the term surgery is more ambiguous than we all thought, and it's really their suggested modification is to include something about invasive procedure. And again, even in radiology, you can put a stent in the wrong iliac artery. You can scope the wrong orifice. So, I mean, I think we're all, sounds to me like everybody's sort of grappling with, it's not just the historical, traditional surgical thing. It's really, this modification suggestion is that we open it up and make sure that things that occur outside of what we're talking about for traditional surgery also get reported, and that we define what that means in terms of wrong body part, or that we make the definition such that people can evaluate, yep, this is a wrong body part because we stented the wrong iliac artery, for example.
So I agree, Lee. I think that's really where we need to be heading for sure. So what suggestions would you have to make this clear? I know that as we go through this and perhaps later on we're really going to deal with the modifications that have been submitted. I certainly understand that the definition of surgery is changing, probably rapidly changing, so that there are lots of procedures that are being done that we don't traditionally think about as surgery, but certainly count. And one of the things that hospitals and ambulatory centers are concerned about is being tagged, particularly in public reports, with having lots of wrong site surgeries whenever it may be some other kind of procedure. So that's certainly an issue in terms of public reporting.
Bill Rosenblatt again. I mean, it's interesting because in the New York stuff, we didn't even include this. you were talking about Massachusetts licensing of ambulatory surgery centers. In New York, we sort of bypassed that and just required that any place that performed ambulatory surgery under anesthesia be certified under what the Department of Health then picked as a certifying agency, and they essentially certified all three, the AAA, the Quad A, and JCAH,
mm-hmm.
certifying agencies. So you have to operate in a certified area. We didn't even talk about wrong site surgery. But I think that it is important, obviously. Just a quick question. NQF's a national organization. We make these recommendations, but who do people report to? I mean, because this is almost a state's rights issue.
Absolutely. And I think, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, none of these actually get reported to the NQF. The NQF is the vehicle that different states would use in their reports. But it's up to each state exactly what they report and how they report it.
That's exactly correct. The NQF has no control and no prerogative to impose reporting with these serious reportable events. We just kind of put them through process, make sure that we can substantiate them, they become endorsed by our board, and then the uptake is entirely up to the marketplace, and the most common area being at the state-based reporting levels.
In other words, the states that didn't have any sort of regulations could take a look at these and utilize these for their state.
That's correct. And of the 28 reporting states now, most of them use the SREs or a version thereof.
So one of the things that that everybody sort of holds their breath to happen is every spring after the January sort of toting up time, all these reports come out on the front page of the Boston Globe. So I'm not sure how other states do their reporting, and I think that most people, as you can see from the list that Lindsay sent us, are using the NQF guidelines. So I think going back to the wrong surgery piece, do we have any additional specifications there that we would like to add? We still have the opportunity to look at the new suggestions later, but if we want to include some of those now while we're thinking about them, I think that's fine.
Well, on the implementation guidance under 1A, it defines how they're defining surgery.
Right.
So I think as we look through that, I guess the question for us is the TAP is, do we think that definition needs any revision based on what we've just talked about. One question I had is, this is talking about how they define surgery doesn't really include things like radiation therapy, which is not surgical. It's, yeah, I guess you could talk about whether we think it's invasive or not. You know, radiation beams puncture mucous membranes, but it's invisible. So I don't know whether this definition should include radiation therapy as things that should be reported if we irradiate the wrong body part, which unfortunately can happen and has happened.
Yeah. This is Jim Bajan. I'm on. I'm sorry. I don't know, about 5 minutes ago. I got tied up in traffic.
Yeah, hi, Jim. It's Peter Ann. Good. Thanks for joining us. We're just getting started. We've done introductions, and we're still in the early stages of going through the list, but thanks for getting online.
So I guess that's the issue to talk about in terms of specifications is what is surgery? You know, do we include the other things, particularly since in a hospital it's obviously very separate, but in an ambulatory or an office-based practice, it's not so clear exactly what we're talking about. You know, you certainly don't have to go to the operating room to have radiation therapy, but you do have to have the big machine and all the other things there. So, you know, is that going to be it or not? One of the issues, I guess, is as we're talking about surgery and wrong site surgery, that's a huge issue, I think, for most people is, when does surgery end? Those are issues that we can talk about. Not only what is surgery, but all the parts and pieces as we go through that. So, for the wrong body part, are we fairly happy going? We may need to revisit this when we look at the new newly submitted SREs, or do we need to sort of debate about wrong site or surgery again?
As a process question, I had thought that our role as the TAP is to specifically address the suggested modifications that came from the open query, and somebody has made some suggested modifications. Do we need to specifically address our views on their modification?
Peter? Yeah, let me clarify that. The steering committee has not reviewed and discussed these suggested modifications themselves, and so the steering committee will deliberate on those as well. We're hoping that you'll do both, make comment on the existing SRE as it sits, and then also make some comment on those suggested modifications. The steering committee will have its deliberation, and then we will be giving the TAPs further feedback after the steering committee to see if that impacts your thoughts or the types of recommendations you may make on these, either the SRE itself or the suggested modifications. But we don't, I guess just a word of caution, because the steering committee has not gone through these suggested modifications themselves, I wouldn't have you guys spend an excess amount of time on each of those because it may be a waste of your time depending on how the steering committee takes it. The other two TAPs that we've run through already covered the suggested modifications. They made some brief comments, and we've got inputs on those. So it's helpful to have it from you guys.
So I guess in terms of the regular list, the list that the 28 that we have now that came out in 2006, the thought that I had about them were which ones of these are actually appropriate to the ambulatory care setting or to the office-based surgery setting first. And then as we do that, are there differences either in the specifications that we think there or in the implementation guidance, probably particularly in the implementation guidance in this ambulatory setting. So that was one of my thought processes as we were looking through that. So, you know, we can decide that certainly all of the surgical events are either should fit and that seems reasonable or not. And as we go through them, I think it's going to be particularly important to see exactly what kinds of implementation comments that everyone has. So in terms of wrong site, I think The implementation would be that perhaps that ambulatory care centers should have the same kind of identification and marking and the other pieces of team-based care that hospitals do. That seem something that we need to debate, or how do we actually implement that, particularly in an office?
Well, is that what we're supposed to figure out, or are we just trying to define the report?
We're just maybe adding some implementation ideas there. You know, they're all going to comments. All are going to go to the steering committee for their thoughts. I think the most important part that I can think about, and Peter helped me out, is that we need to see the differences is really what we're interested in. The ones that we have here were devised for hospitals. You know, are there different ways of implementing these guidelines? Should there be different ways of implementing the guidelines? Are there different specifications? And we've talked a little about the specifications. So that's essentially the discussion as I'm thinking about it. And you may have a different idea about that. And Peter, you can give me some guidance there as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly helpful. If you want to utilize the templates that we provided for you guys to sort of get the momentum going a little bit more, that might be helpful. It's got some questions and prompts. One of the TAPs used that template strategy, and it got them through fairly expeditiously. The other TAP had free-flow discussion but got through everything. So it's your call, but what you just described is reasonable too.
Okay. Well, I'm looking for the questions and prompts piece of my literature. I just thought about going through the list that we have, but we can do the questions and prompts
if that helps. It was meant as an option. Lindsay, do you happen to have those up or available to go up on the screen?
I do.
If you could show that for the group, that would be great.
I see here that you're missing is have a timeout. Timeouts are the thing hospitals now have in every operative procedure that tries to avoid, you know, this, wrong site, wrong patient, and all that other sort of stuff prior to the incision.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, those are pretty solid guidelines for hospitals to have, but not necessarily how do you implement them in an office-based setting or probably most ambulatory surgery centers already had those as guidelines too. So,
very simple. I mean, you know, ambulatory surgery center is not different from an office. I mean, an office maybe there's only one OR, and an ambulatory center maybe more than one OR. Could only be one OR. You can have a timeout, you know, at a barbecue. I mean, timeout is nothing. All it says is stop, look, and listen and see what's cooking.
Right.
I guess this is Lee. I'm struggling with, but it's, I didn't think it was our role in this advisory group to sort of make recommendations or make guidance about how people would prevent wrong site surgery. I thought we were more defining the measure that some people might use to report. Peter, help me.
No, I think that's an important clarification, and this is the same difficulty we had with the other TAPs, where you're trying to keep what the focus is in terms of how do you prevent and change practice to improve the prevention strategies, or is it just about the reporting and if an event occurs? And it's for the purpose of this, it's pretty much what types of events should be reported and should not happen. The actual analysis as to what caused the problem and then any steps to improve safety, that's up to the individual situations and the organizations that are caught. This is more about what types of events should be reported.
So why don't we just use the template and go through each of the 28 and sort of answer some of these questions. I think it's up on the screen, and so we can just start with number one. You know, do we think this is relevant? and we need to have some accountability around it. Certainly for 1A, what's your answer? Mine would be yes.
Yes.
And, you know, the rationale is, and this is a preventable event, too. So, you know, that would be one of the ones that we would say, you know, this is important to have as a preventable event. So it seems to be discrete. It seems to be auditable. Do you think it's clearly defined?
The question I had on the implementation guidance about the definition of surgery, I thought in my head as I read that, again, sort of a point I made earlier, is that does it need to also include radiation therapy? I know that's not a surgery, but it might occur in an ambulatory center. So I raised that question.
It's Peter. Several individuals and organizations would advocate yes with you.
Yes.
That's something the steering committee will eventually have to weigh in on, right?
Yeah, and it I think it would be helpful for you guys to put that as a recommendation.
Okay. So I think there's not any question that it meets all the criteria of a serious reportable event. It is serious. It's unambiguous, and we think it's preventable. So we're pretty good there. I guess I really can't think of very many modifications for 1A. Is it entirely preventable? I think that's a matter of debate. You know, Pennsylvania certainly has a really substantial way of examining wrong site surgery when it happens. So any response on that one, entirely preventable?
Well, Jim Bajan, certainly, you know, to say entirely is a big word. It's like never and always.
Right.
However, I can tell you, looking back over millions of procedures now since 2002, since we've been using essentially, maybe it's slightly more restricted, but what's universal protocol, for instance, from the VA, from the Joint Commission, we have not had an incorrect surgery as to, site, procedure, implant, patient, where there hasn't been flagrant violation of just general procedures like patient identification, things like that. So, I mean, we kind of feel almost anymore to say always is a tough one, but if you eliminate things like where the path report in the lab has been fouled up and, you know, they end up saying patient A has patient B's disease, so you operate on them and find out it was the wrong patient, we don't consider that a surgical error. You know, that's a lab error, it's something different, but
still preventable.
Still preventable.
But as the things we're looking at particularly, I think not anymore, it'd be hard to, we consider them intentionally unsafe acts right now and investigate them that way rather than as a safety violation.
Okay. All right.
I was just saying,
done 1A pretty well. Everybody satisfied with that? Can we move on to 1B, the wrong patient?
Can I? This is Debbie Wheeler. I had a quick question on that. I know we possibly don't want to discuss the added modifications, but I actually do agree that to keep the measures kind of the same so you can trend over time,
right.
I would say separate surgical versus invasive, but still add that invasive piece to it, but I think you may want to keep those separate somehow.
Okay. So, you know, I think that's one can be one of our recommendations for sure.
Yep.
You mean to create a separate measure for things that are invasive but not surgery?
That's what I'm thinking. I know it may be difficult to do that, but my concern from a QI perspective is how you actually trend things over time because, you know, many states want to do that.
Right.
So once you change measures, it's difficult to do that.
Because the other perspective would be to broaden the existing definition to include more things. And what I hear you saying is if you did that, your number might go up or your rate may go up over time, and that would potentially create somebody having a problem with that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so either, I guess it's either perspective. So you can broaden it out, but do you keep it as a separate category if you're broadening it out? Or do you put them together, but someone has to make clear that it's a different definition?
This is Jim Bajan. I mean, I think one way I would kind of look at it, we've thought about this, if I'm understanding you correctly, we will break it out as a sub thing. For instance, if we look at things that we think are not surgery, we have our definitions. But because the same processes are what mitigate the risk, we keep it in one category that way, because from the we look at it from the end user perspective, you know, the clinician, the provider, same skills and techniques they're using, you know?
No, and I don't disagree. I think it's just how it's going to be publicly reported, which is always the other piece of that. So if things are going in newspapers or in reports by the states and the rate looks to be, you know, higher than before, there has to be clear explanation of that.
I agree. But, you know, I think there also has to be the caveat, though. These rates, no matter how you get the data, are rates of what's reported. They're not rates of what happened.
You know, I can't disagree with that either, but, you know, somehow making that differential for the public is really tough.
Oh, I know, but I mean, I think we have to, even among ourselves, be careful to always use the modifier. This is the reported rate. This is what was reported, because we start to get sloppy, and then we know what we mean, but many other people, they just say, we say this is the rate.
Right.
I don't think there's any qualifier whatsoever.
Hey, this is Lee. I have a point of process. I know Jim Bajan very well. He's one of my heroes, but he probably needs an opportunity to disclose, since he wasn't here for that formality.
Yeah, no, that's fine, and we've done that before. I just didn't want to interrupt the flow of discussion at that moment. Jim, very briefly, what organization you represent, and do you have any disclosures as part of our formal process that we did at the beginning of the call?
Sure, yeah, I'm sorry I was late.
No problem.
This is Jim Bajan. I'm a Chief Patient Safety Officer at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I don't know that I have any conflicts other than that to disclose.
All right, thanks, Jim. Jim's legacy with wrong side surgery is well known in terms of how the VA has managed all this, so his inputs on this particular part of our day is important.
And Jim, to follow up on a point you made earlier about this is really whether we're lumpers or splitters.
Right.
You mentioned about the processes of care being the same to prevent wrong site surgery versus wrong site other procedures. That also is part of one of the modification suggestions on this and the next one about, do you include wrong site surgery as being the wrong patient? Right now it's two separate measures, but I wondered if your thought was that, given that from the process standpoint, you might consider them one, but right now they're two.
I think if we've been, well, do we want to get into that? I don't want to derail the order.
Okay, sorry.
I mean, I'm happy to make a comment when we get to that.
Well, how about we go through each of these procedure-oriented ones and then come back to that type of a question.
Yeah. So, so as sort of a way of ending up, I guess, this wrong body part thing, I think we're pretty well with that. So any further comments or questions about wrong site?
Well, are we going to discuss, I'm sorry, you might have said this earlier, this is Jim Bajan. Are we going to discuss the suggested modifications at this point about 1A or not?
We're actually going to discuss, we're going to try to go through all of the current 28 and then have time later to go through the newly submitted ones.
Okay.
Modifications. That's the way we thought of doing it.
That's fine. No, that's my fault for not knowing, because I was like, getting away. That's fine.
Sure. So, are we cooked on 1A?
Yes.
Okay. So now then we get to go ahead and go to Jim's thoughts about wrong patient, if you will. That we wanted to get into.
I think this comes to the lumpers and splitters. I mean, we certainly break our data out this way because it's kind of a phenotype or genotype thing. When we originally looked at this stuff back in 2001, people tend to talk about wrong-sided surgery.
Right.
And that's how they talked about it. And we found that really, you know, there was wrong side, wrong site, wrong patient, wrong implant. Were some of the major issues, and we found that, for instance, I think if I remember right, 44%, we call them incorrect surgeries, were wrong side, 39% were wrong patient, and nobody had ever seen that before that we were aware of that had the data to be able to dissect it that way, And it was because the phenotype, to give a simple example, it's if, like, say, Peter and I were both going to have our knees scoped this morning, and I was going to have my right knee scoped, and he was going to have his left knee scoped, and they confused us in the holding area, and they said, oh, Peter, and I just grunted, uh-huh, and next thing you know, they go in and scope me, and when I find me more lucid, I look and you go, and my comment is, you did the wrong side,
right?
Which is true, but that's the phenotype. The genotype was they thought I was Peter Angood.
Yep.
And it was only obvious in the other reports before you could dissect them, it was if Peter was going to have a cervical laminectomy and I was having my knee scoped, everybody would have recognized that as wrong patient. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I guess the other similar example is for the ophthalmologist putting in the wrong lens whenever they just line up all the lenses for the day.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. You know, and people say, oh, you put the wrong lens. Well, really, you thought you put the correct lens and you just thought it was somebody else.
Exactly.
And it implies a different solution to prevent that problem. So for that reason, we kind of look at them. They're under the whole rubric of incorrect surgery is what we call it. But wrong patient implies a whole different causation stream than wrong procedure, if you know what I mean.
Yep. Anyone else we need to go through? And, you know, it seems absolutely relevant in terms of just sort of going through our questions and we certainly want to keep wrong patient in. Do we need to make some modifications there? You know, the rationale is good, and it goes back to Jim's point of how exactly we're going to define wrong patient. And do we need to say something perhaps in our response about implementation and give this as an example that's particularly relevant, I think, for ambulatory surgery centers? Okay, it seems like a very discreet event. Well, I guess not. You know, if we take it that wrong patient is not necessarily the way we think about it, so it may not be as discreet as previously thought. Should we any pieces of that we can break out and make it clearer?
I guess I was impressed with most of these. That the way the definitions were written, I thought were very well thought out. And in my opinion, in general, I thought, you know, because I'm pretty picky about some of these things because we've been bounced around it a lot.
Right.
I thought, you know, it was composed very well. I guess the only question, I think they're pretty well as they are, but, and you mentioned ophthalmology, which, you know, I consider the bad boy that we see again and again. That there seems to be a lack of appreciation for the rigor that needs to be followed about how they handle things, identification of patient and the devices, the implants. So I wonder, would it be worthwhile in some of these sometimes to give an example to make it contextual? Because I think, you know, I can tell you dealing with some of the ophthalmologists, because it's the one that's our biggest problem child, that they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And if you get past that initial yeah, 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 and get into it, they're not understanding some of the vulnerabilities. They're, you know, in what they think is being more efficient, that's the reason they're getting bitten at a far higher attack rate, if you will, than everybody else. And I wondered, would it doesn't have to be an ophthalmology example, but they're one of the ones that is
they're easy picking.
Yeah, and I mean, I wonder to pick, you know, not to pick on in a specialty, but is it worth, you know, giving a contextual example helps make it realer for somebody. Whereas, while this is written very clearly, I think it's exactly right. It's well written. An example helps make it live more for people. It's just a thought in general.
I think it's very clearly written, and if you can't figure it out,
it's like an IQ test. Well, I've said that myself.
Okay. I think this definitely meets the definitional criteria. It's serious, it's unambiguous, and for the most part, it should be preventable?
Yes.
Largely preventable?
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely.
So I think the other piece, and here's one place that we can look at some of the implementation guidance, and that's whenever surgery ends. Is a huge question for lots of people, particularly whenever they want to talk about the device. if they discovered that they put the wrong lens in and decide that they're going to fix it then, does that count or not? You know, some of those issues?
I guess that's a good point. If you actually done it, you know, put it in, now you're going to take it out.
Right.
That's wrong. I mean,
gotcha.
Would you tell patient, we say our litmus test is, so would you tell the patient, oh, yeah, we did the one for practice, then we did it again to do it the right way.
Right. Okay. So you agree with the implementation once the incision has been closed? So once you flap the cornea back, you're done?
Yeah, actually with this one, because in most cases the ophthalmologists actually do the retrobulbar block themselves.
Right.
So we consider, and we have some of those where they put the block in and they're getting ready to do the incision and somebody wakes up and goes, hey, wait a minute, is this the correct side? We consider that an incorrect patient right off the bat.
Okay.
You put the needle, and that's why I like the fact they talk about procedure in which skin or mucous membranes is incised or instrument is introduced.
And yeah.
That gets the retrobulbar block. They own it.
As part of it. Correct.
This is Peter. This is an important topic to resolve, and so your guys' input as a TAP will be critical here. There's a lot of debate out there where end of surgery is, and we've been fending off the hordes, if you will, because we knew we'd cover this in this particular TAP as well as with the steering committee. So your input's critical on this definition of end of surgery.
So while we're talking about end of surgery, we're going to sort of have that as a debate through the next couple of these events. So as we go through, if we can keep that in mind, it really would be helpful. So 1B is as clear in definitional wise as we would like it to be.
Good to go from my standpoint.
Okay.
I agree.
Everybody else?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. 1C, the wrong surgical procedure performed on a patient. So that's Jim's Peter's. One should have a laminectomy and one should have a knee operation. So
the other example I would give that might make it a little more ambiguous is even if you do a laminectomy, the wrong level is done.
Yeah.
That to me should count, and I don't know that that's defined enough to where you could come to that conclusion if you read this, if you're thinking about reporting some.
Right.
And yeah, I think this one, I have a little problem because it says wrong surgical procedure. So, for example, doing the wrong level. The procedure was right. It's just the wrong level. As far as we're concerned, that's, you didn't do, it's an incorrect surgery, which isn't the example. It says insertion of wrong medical implant into the correct surgical site. We call that, we call them wrong implant as a separate category. We would call it a wrong procedure if you did the wrong level or wrong site, because we also see it with hand surgeons especially.
Right.
Find a hand where, we had them, they're looking at the dorsum of the hand and they're counting digits, and then they flip it over and they're still counting like left to right, if you will, and instead of being the middle finger, they're now on the ring finger. So they still did the PIP, but it's the wrong finger when they flipped it over, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
And that's an incorrect procedure as far as we're concerned.
So would it be, we should, under the guidance that says the event is intended to capture, Jim, are you suggesting that we also put on there not just wrong implant, but also wrong level of surgery, perhaps?
A wrong level or wrong site. See, because here it says, I would modify this one myself, I think, because there's two different issues, I think, at least. This one, as it says now, it says insertion of the wrong medical implant in the correct surgical site. So, I mean, we've seen people put the left hip prosthesis into the right, okay? That would certainly be that.
Right.
It would also be, as you mentioned a second ago, I put the wrong lens, because I'm doing a whole bunch of lens implants in a row, and I get them screwed up, and I put, Peter's into me. That would be this, too, according to this, right?
Yes.
Because there's not a wrong implant category. But then the other one is the wrong level that was brought up. You did the correct implant, let's say, say you fused a vertebrae and put a cage with bone graft material in it. You did the right you did what you intended to do was correct. You just did it at the wrong level, so that's a different issue. Or you put the joint implant into the wrong finger. You know, it was the right medical implant, but into the wrong surgical site. So there's two different things here, you know?
Right. So the wrong level is a huge issue for us in terms of the kinds of things we get reported. It's really common. I don't know what everybody else's experience is.
After ophthalmology, they're number two for us.
Yeah.
Also shouldn't even involve an implant. I mean, it's just wrong procedure.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. We do ours differently. We have a separate thing that is strictly implant because we did for this confusion factor.
I mean, it could also be, you know, correct implant in wrong site.
That's exactly, and we see those too.
Oh, and I mean, it has to have three parts here. I mean, you know, wrong medical implant into correct site, fine. Correct implant into wrong site, and just
right procedure but wrong site.
Procedure in the wrong site.
That's right. I agree. We break them out all three ways so we can track them because they are different.
End up calling your malpractice carrier when you close the patient. That has to be here.
So those are great comments. So in terms of implementation guidance, perhaps we can talk about that and submit that as an important piece of this one for sure. That would definitely clarify things and make it much less ambiguous.
So would we suggest adding two additional bullets or where it says, you know, in the column, you know, the center column says this event is intended to capture and it just right now has one bullet, insertion of wrong medical implant into the correct site. We have to hit the other two things, right?
Yeah, I think we can certainly submit that as our response and as a rationale, just all of the things that we just talked about that, you know, it really is sort of three things and not just the one that we have up there.
The other category, because if we give the intent to capture and we give just implant examples, you know, we want to make sure that the scope is broader. For example, removal of the wrong organ or biopsy of the wrong organ.
Right.
Seen that too. And
yep.
To me, that fits in here as well. You take out the kidney thinking you were taking out the spleen.
Yeah, seen a couple of those. I think the common one for the radiologist is biopsying the liver instead of in someone who really was there to have their kidney biopsy.
Yeah.
Right. And see, then it comes down to understanding on that one, you know, for instance, is it because they didn't know what they were supposed to do or they're doing what they thought they were supposed to do, but it's the wrong patient, you know?
Right.
Right.
And we see both.
Yeah. So have we captured all of the parts of that, do you think?
We certainly expanded it.
Yeah. So...
Can I ask a question, you know, on this? I wonder, I mean, and certainly doing it the way we just said, I think would be correct and thorough. But I wonder, would it almost be better, and maybe we can't do this, but I just want to ask the question, instead of, you know, here we have C, wrong surgical procedure performed on a patient. And there, if you did that, you could define it versus wrong site. It's different, like, you know, it depends on how you want to say procedure. You know, we would say if the procedure was do an implant of an artificial joint in the third digit PIP, right? And you did that procedure, except you did it in the second finger, PIP. The procedure, now here gets the question, did the procedure include which finger it was, or was the PIP? You know, we would say if you did it in the correct patient, this was the wrong site. The procedure was putting the implant in. You just put it in the wrong place. You know, I mean, we look at them differently because the causation is slightly different. You know, versus if you had the wrong patient, like with the lens ones for the ophthalmologist usually, they don't know which patient they're doing what on because they didn't identify the patient to the procedure. That implies, you know, some different solutions because of the causation. It depends on how you want to use the information. I think you can get it either way, and by putting the specifications in the definition here, it would be thorough and complete.
Yeah. You know, I think the issue is we'd probably like to keep these as broad as we can keep them where there can be a little interpretation, at least by some of the different entities that are going to use them. Peter?
And I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gina, Debbie, any comments about this?
No, I agree with the discussion.
Yeah, this is Gina. I agree, too. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's move on to 1D. So this is a huge place to talk about when surgery ends again. So let's talk about